You're right ahead.
So tonight, I'm of course pleased and delighted to have one of the founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea, and one of a good friend of many decades, and a Taiyu meditation teacher for 25, 30 years now, something like that.
I guess close to 30 years.
Tonight, Rob Schmidt is one of the founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea, the powerhouse behind it. And and he is also a PhD in archaeology. He is the author of this book, co-editor of The Archaeologies of Sexuality, which we have here. And tonight he has said that he wanted to merge his two principal interests in life, which are the exploration of the true self, or is the group they have. He leads, what is it called?
Non-phenomenal self.
The true self, the non-phenomenal self, and archaeology. I've heard him talk about both in succession, but I am very much looking forward to Rob's observations on the archaeology of the self this evening. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you. I'm going to have another. I've just had a bite of, for those of you listening in posterity, I've just had a bite of the cherry pie, which has been brought out with candles on it, which I blew out. And now I'm eating a little bit of the apple pie. So, there's actually a friend of mine. In fact, the co-editor of that book said she couldn't make it tonight, but she wanted to be able to listen to this talk. So, so Barb, I'm chewing. So, these are indeed, as Jim said, two of my enduring interests in this body, and the one is the exploration of what the self means, what the self is, what it might consist of, how we might find out about it, and archaeology, which is the study of human behavior in the past, especially focusing upon the inferences that we can make about that behavior based upon the material culture remains of people that people in the past have left behind. That often means things like stone tools, bits of ceramic, either whole or in part, and other things that survive fairly spectacularly, given the way that things tend to degrade over time. Most things, except really hard things, tend to erode, tend to dissolve, tend to become something else. In fact, the Buddhists have a way to talk about this, which, when I first heard it, didn't make a lot of sense to me. I didn't understand what the big deal was. But this Buddhist concept is the concept that things are composite. That is, that they are made of many things. And composite things that are made of many things are constantly coming together and coming apart and recombining in new configurations. So this process of recombining is actually one of the things that archaeologists look at when they look at what's called the archaeological record. That is, the material culture remains of past human behavior. And so archaeologists are looking at these material culture remains in order to make inferences about what created those remains, the behaviors that created those remains. I'm going to get into some of the specifics of that in a moment, but first I want to just give you the overview, the basic view, which is that this process is a process that we can, in many ways, analogize to the process that we can use to come to understand ourselves. To come to understand not just the word self and how it gets applied in ordinary life, and the many ways in which it gets applied, but also, perhaps, in some ways that it doesn't get ordinarily applied in ordinary life, unless we're reading a book about Hindu philosophy or something like that. So back to archaeology. It's making inferences about behavior. So, to give you a sense of what an archaeologist might do to make an inference about behavior, I'm going to give you something very concrete to look at, because that's the sort of material culture evidence that we want to examine. And so I'm going to look at all of the things that I was given today on my birthday. We're going to look at these things as material culture evidence of behavior. Maybe it's material culture evidence of the way people have thought about me and related to me, or imagine that I have thought about them and related to them. So we start with an envelope and a document, which has writing on top and on the inside and a pretty picture. It also has another document inside, which can be redeemed for other material culture items. I see something has just been added to the pile. Oh dear. Here. And this bag with the little colored ribbon was in the pile. We have many more documents, actually. And they're quite interesting. Some of them, have pictures, as you see. Lovely pictures with envelopes that they came in. Other pictures, sentiments handwritten and sentiments pre-printed. Same thing here. It's a lovely picture in this one. And then more things with lots of handwriting in this one. There are even, oh goodness, look at this inclusion here. There's another documentary inclusion in this one. What a generous documentary inclusion. What did you call it today? A Benjamin? I wasn't familiar with that term before. I'll get to these recently added documentary pieces. But here's the thing. It's a bar of soap, apparently. It says, "Filthy cowboy, delicate dude."
What can we infer from that?
Indeed. That's what I'm asking. What can we infer from that? It's got a picture of a cowboy. He's definitely a rather duded-up cowboy with quite a nice mustache, not unlike... maybe even longer than yours. But he's got a certain look on his face, and his eyes are looking up in this particular way. His hat is a white hat, and it looks quite clean. It hasn't been spending much time in the dirt, so he doesn't look like a very filthy cowboy now. But that's one of the material culture. What does it smell like? That's a very good question.
How do we know
I can't smell very much through the plastic.
Okay. How do we know the function of this alleged soap?
That's a good question. It does say, just because you've got a hankering for a vanilla bean and ylang, whatever that means, don't mean you can't shoot straight. I used to use any old saddle soap, but now I know better. Apparently, this is a horse speaking here on the back of the package.
So that would be a mythical animal uttering a prayer?
Possibly. This was another inclusion in one of the documentary pieces earlier, and it's sort of plastic, it's flat, it says gift card Lowe's on there. So that's another bit of the evidence that we're examining. There's also, there's more stuff over there. But let's look at some more of these documents. Aha, look at this. A happy birthday card with the happy birthday spelled out in colorful vegetables. A very cool and interesting card that I believe could even be purchased, or one like it, at a store like this. And yet another bit of documentary evidence. A very colorful card indeed. And more handwriting in this case. Oh my goodness. And it's got a really small number. And I'm not even sure how I would say this number. It's one with one, two, three, four. One with 26 zeros after it's 1 over 1 with 26 zeros. And that's a lot of littleness, it seems to me, mentioned in that particular piece of documentary evidence. I bring this because even though it didn't come today, this iPad, it was a Christmas present, but the person who gave it to me, I could not accept it just for Christmas. I had to say this is for my birthday too. So I brought that along as well. And then I have other goodies. Look at this. Okay, here's something you can make an inference about. This is a bottle. It's a black looking bottle. It's called Reale Cardamone Colli di Salerno. Indicazione Geografica Tipica. Red wine of Italy. Red wine of Italy. And
right in front of the Buddha.
No, not right in front of the Buddha, to the side of the Buddha. And then we've got other pieces of documentary evidence here. This is a what appears to be a book called Sacred Sonoma. Another book called Thank God for Evolution. How the Marriage of Science and Religion Will Transform Your Life and Our World. And last but not least in this list, A Book of Cinquains by poet Jim Wilson. So you see, I have a lot of evidence if I want to make some inferences about the behavior and other aspects of the way that the people who provided these pieces of material culture evidence behave, and what their relationship to the recipient of these gifts might be. We don't have to go into the specifics.
Well, what would you infer?
What would I infer? I would infer lots of things. I might infer that someone thinks I like red wine, Italian red wine, for example. And I might infer that someone wants to make a joke about my both needing a bath but already looking so good that I hardly even need to have a bath at the same time because of the wrapping that this piece of soap has come in. And a further inference would be that this person is meaning to share a joke with me, and that is a thing that we can share together, for example.
What do you base that inference on?
I'm basing that inference upon the particulars. It's hard. I can send this around. I can send this around and people can look at it. Here. That's the thing about material culture evidence. You really have to look at it yourself to get a sense of some of the things
that are
using many things internal to you to say something about this.
That is absolutely true. And what else could I do? That's one thing that archaeologists do, and it's one of the problematic things that archaeologists do when they make their inferences. In other words, they make inferences about behavior in the past based on things they can't see, and based further upon and processes that they infer exist, number one, and as well, they make inferences based upon their observed behavior of human beings. Both those things, yeah.
Is there a methodological distinction between, and I'm just talking out loud because I don't know if there is such a distinction between evidence and inference?
You know, sure.
Like, you know, evidence, a spear, inference, therefore they ward.
This brings up an interesting point that I wanted to get to anyway, and that is that evidence, our general picture, non-archaeologists have this picture of you take a shovel and you dig in the dirt and you find this cool thing and you say, look at this, they must have liked gold cats, if you found a gold cat. Or they must have liked, you know, whatever it is you happen to have found. Right? But what archaeologists, who are subtle, more subtle archaeologists at least, do, is actually look not just at the thing, but they look at the context in which it is found. So the material culture evidence consists not just of the one cool thing, it also consists of the entirety of the context in which that cool thing is found. That includes the sediments, perhaps, which might give clues about when and how that thing found its way into that particular archaeological context. It might include as well adjacent items that might be related or might not be related, depending upon where they are in reference to different colored soils or sediments, for example, which might indicate different sedimentary processes that would have contributed to the creation of that context in which it's found. Now, I've just brought here a bunch of stuff, and you might have to take my word for it that except for the things that I got just in a few minutes ago, most of these things were on my table in the morning, my place at the table in the dining room in my house when I came down for breakfast. If you were disposed not to believe me, you might ask me for further evidence to support this. But evidence is always something we interrogate. And in fact, you ask this question about evidence. Another way to talk about it is facts. Historians, as well as archaeologists, have to decide what a fact is and what a fact means. We think that these things are straightforward and obvious, but they're not. And that's very relevant to my purpose tonight, to try to understand what might be a fact when we're looking at something like the self. So it's a very relevant question. And this whole arena of interrogation is an important part of the archaeological process. And I will suggest that it is an important part of the process of coming to see, know, and understand the self in all its many manifestations. So, That's just some of the background. Did I answer your question about inference sufficiently? We could talk a lot more about this for sure, and how people make inferences about the past. But you're right to point out that I have to make inferences about behavior in the past based upon my understanding of how people in the present behave. There's even a branch of archaeology called experimental archaeology, where archaeologists try to reproduce the ways in which an archaeological deposit might occur. So you might have somebody deliberately, like for a month, walking on a patch of ground where you've sprinkled some artifacts or something, and see what happens. Because we know that in real archaeological deposits, it's not like, let's say I dropped a dime in the gutter out there. It's not like suddenly somebody puts yellow tape around it that lasts 10,000 years, and nobody can walk around that artifact that I dropped outside. Things are happening to archaeological deposits, to archaeological evidence, just as they are happening to the evidence that relates to the investigation of the self. Yes?
So if one's investigating the self, are there artifacts that sit around for a long time, like more or less undisturbed or maximally walked on or something?
I think that's a really good question. What do you think? What's the first thing that comes to mind for you?
Well, I could say some things that I think, but...
Well, go ahead. Well, yeah.
I don't think that things, like, sort of remain sort of, like, under the earth undisturbed.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe, like, things about the self could remain unexplored but are still participating as life moves forward.
Okay.
If that makes sense. What I'm saying.
Sure.
Right now.
Sure.
So just like looking at the analogy that they're making tonight. And
well, that would... Go ahead. Did you want to finish?
No, I'm just looking at the analogy and seeing what I can get from it.
Got it. Well, remember that I said that things are composite, as the Buddha said. Things are not pure for the most part. Most things are aggregations, and that's true for the archaeological record for sure. And I'm going to suggest that it's also true for the various aspects of what we call the self. And we'll hopefully get into that in a moment, what that means. But let's posit for the moment that the self, or many aspects of what we call the self, are like that too. They are composite. They are aggregates, aggregations of other things. And in fact, they are continually coming together. Parts of them are dissolving, leaving, becoming disassociated from what was formerly the self, etc. I mean, we can see how that must happen with respect to the body, right? That's an easy example. Many of us think about the body as being a locus, at least one locus of what we might call the self. And yet, the body is always changing. It never stops changing at any point in the life history of the organism. At any point. There are points when it seems more or less stable, and we tell ourselves that it's stable, but of course we also know that we're constantly ingesting substances, adding more composite items to it, and it is excreting composite items, and not just the ones that we see. We're excreting air molecules as well. So there's a constant flux and flow. And why would not the self have this same feature to it? Or most aspects of what we might call a self. Me, myself, and I. That funny phrase is an indication, or can be, we can use it as an indication, that in fact, that's what we've got when we're looking at the self. It's a collection of things. It is perhaps then, as many spiritual teachers suggest to us, a fiction that we tell ourselves that there is a discrete self that has always been present, or that was created by some divine being or whatever, and is untouched by, unaffected by, all the things that are happening to us.
What are you inferring that from?
What am I inferring what from?
This discrete self?
I'm saying that there are many people who make the argument, who assert that there is something like, oh, thank you, that there is something like a discrete self, they call it a soul often, that is not changed. It has features which are invariant and unchanging, and it can presumably, through its association with the human body, or other things. This is the assertion. Some of the assertions that I'm talking about.
Does this follow from me, myself, and I?
No. I'm just talking about this stuff as we understand the term the self. It's not like there's a strict definition of the self, although I'd be happy for you to give me one. Go ahead.
I'd be happy to.
Go ahead.
I'd be happy to.
Okay. You'd be happy three.
I'd be happy
to. You yourself and you?
Right.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'm suggesting is that in fact, most of the things that we think of when we think of myself, what I have experienced, my life, my gifts, my pie, my wine, my seat, my body, is always changing. It is not stable. The aggregations are constantly in flux of these things. That's what I'm suggesting, that it seems like that to me. And I don't expect anyone here to take my word for it. I'm suggesting that it's interesting to look at the evidence for these things ourselves. And the point of the talk is to use this analogously, to use this this tool of archaeological thinking, inferential thinking, as a way to do that. Because one of the things that is true even about the self we think we know, whatever that means, I mean, we get up in the morning and we usually don't question that I am me, right? This is my house, this is my bedroom, this is my spouse, or this is my dog, you know, all that stuff. We don't question those things. And yet, what does it mean to say that? To say that those are mine, me. What does it mean for me to receive birthday gifts from people? What is the inference there? Amma, could you cease doing that, please? Thank you. The
The point is that all these things are reifying, are creating an illusion that there is a stable self. And the stable self, I'm suggesting for your consideration, doesn't hold water if you look at it. At least for the most part. I'm not saying when we come to final, but at least the stuff that we're used to thinking of as stable, those things are not stable. They are constantly in flux and in change.
It's useful.
What's useful?
To think of it as stable.
Why? Why?
Because it gives you a way to move through the day and undertake things. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you're thinking of yourself as being constantly in flux, and I would say that way leads to madness.
Well, I got that. That's the bill of goods. That's the bill of goods that we're told, that we're sold as kids. That's what we're told by people. That if you don't buy these ideas, that if you don't accept that, that in fact you will be crazy. You will be like, you'll be, walking down the street talking apparently to yourself, and of course you wouldn't want that. Even though we all tend to talk to ourselves all the time, we just
mentally.
Exactly, we talk to ourselves in our heads all the time, and there's absolutely no difference except that some of these people are doing it unrestricted and unrestrained out loud. But what I'm suggesting is that there is a way of being, and if you want to call that a capital S self, that's one way that some people have used this, that there is the possibility of a way of relating to life that does not insist on locating reality as being founded upon a bedrock of small self, what I'll call small self. But most people assert encompasses the entirety of our experience for the most part. That's the claim that happens. So I agree with you that that is what we're told, and that is what we naturally come to believe because almost everyone else we know tells us this.
So this makes it easy to interact with them.
With those people? That's right, it does. Because we're all sharing the same convention.
That's right.
And when we're sharing the same convention, then supposedly we can rub along together tolerably well. That's the assertion. But then we look at the world and we see, ooh, it doesn't always seem to work out that way, does it? Because we've got an awful lot of strife in the world.
Sure.
And we've got an awful lot of dysfunctionality in the world. And we've got an awful lot of consequences of actions of these many selves that are supposedly founded on something stable that seem to be going all over the place and have no real foundation in something that allows for the arising of what Gurdjieff called the harmonious human being. Harmonious with her or his environment, harmonious with her or his fellow human beings, harmonious perhaps even with beings at other levels. So, if I were an archaeologist of the self, what would I do? What kind of evidence would I look at to examine this question? I mean, I've just made an assertion here that it's not as simple as we think, that our
that our consensus reality, which is that I am this discrete self, this discrete being, who is the captain of my soul. I'm the captain of my soul, and there are different versions of this, of course. There are folks who will still talk about the self and then refer to the multiple nature of that self. That is, psychologists will point out that we have roles that we play with different people. You know, those are like different selves. And sometimes when we're in a context where we have more than one person that we interact with, customarily in different ways, there can be a disharmony arising in the organism that is something to be afraid of. It's actually just the sort of thing that you were talking about, Betty, there, because if there is this self, the whole point of it is to help us get along harmoniously with people. But what if we're supposed to act one way with one person and one way with another person, and they seem quite discreet, like discreet and different ways to us, and yet we're in the same room with those two people?
Yeah, well, you have to be true to your own self.
Okay, but what is that?
Well, I think you know that...
How do you know?
Well...
I mean, that's what we're asking here.
Yeah.
How do you know? How do you know what that self is, what that true your own self is?
Well, I have certain guidelines when I try to interact with people. I try to interact in as kind a manner as I can,
uh-huh,
without compromising myself to someone else's beliefs. Mm-hmm. I try to be as compassionate as I can. You know, I have these building blocks. And I don't think you have to sacrifice those when you interact with different people.
Uh-huh. But what is this self that there's a concern about compromising? That's the question I'm asking.
Well, a self that's built on these guidelines that you have constructed or have, by experience have come to believe is a way to behave. And
mm-hmm. Okay, that is definitely, you know, goes with this consent, what I'm calling a consensus view of what a self is. I'm also saying, well, maybe it ain't necessarily so. Not that it is necessarily so, but maybe it ain't necessarily so. And I'm asking how we would find out about this. How would we find out about this sort of thing? What would we look at? What kind of evidence would we look at? I mean, it doesn't have to be just you.
Okay.
Anyone here who has... Daniel.
I have a question that's about that.
Okay.
Which is, it's related, so it's not so much what kind of evidence,
okay,
would we look at, but suppose somebody did gather a whole bunch of evidence about their life over... an extended duration of their life.
Mm-hmm.
How and what could someone infer from the evidence, which is like kind of what this metaphor seems to be about? How does the inference happen, and what sort of things would you infer? So what's like the form, and also what's like the purpose? So like, mm-hmm, not only like what do you infer, or how do you infer it, but why would you even care to infer anything in the first place? What would that be serving?
Right. Thank you. That is a question that gets right to the heart of this matter of determining whether there is something that is maybe in addition to this process of creating a consensus self. Not that there's anything wrong with creating a consensus self, but because we all do it. And how could it, you know, it would be sort of, I don't know, self-defeating. Let me finish. I need to spend some time on this one, Betty. Sorry. This is a really crucial question, because this is something that I said was an analogy. Archaeology is an analogy for coming to an understanding of something that we cannot see and whose scope and dimensions, nature and quality, we must infer from evidence that we can see. Okay? So, your question goes to the heart of the matter. If it's just about getting information about this, what the heck would the point be? If instead it is about actually doing something different than just having information about this self, if there is such a thing, then the interesting thing would be to be able to act from that self, which, if the way I'm constructing it makes sense, would be at a level that is different than the consensus level of self that we were talking about a moment ago. This consensus level of self is something that gets built up as soon as we get language as children and are able to incorporate the consensus views of other human beings. But it might be something, in other words, which is present even before there is the ability to manipulate the intellectual realm in the way that the voices in our heads allow us to do. It might be something prior to that. So, if we wanted to make this set of inferences, that isn't really a set of inferences, that is actually a way to embody something authentic that a baby might have a more direct connection to than a human being who has accepted, for good and sufficient reasons, the consensus view of things, then we've got something else. And that's why the archaeological methodology is just an analogy to what I'm talking about here. And that's why when I'm talking about gathering evidence for this kind of inference making, it's an inference being made not by the discursive mind. It's an inference that's arising from, call it a disposition or a capacity within oneself, that my teacher used to call it, use this phrase, that is senior to the mind as we generally know it. The mind as we generally know it is a wonderful thing. It is this thing that allows us to create this consensus self, and actually allows us to create many consensus selves, I'd actually assert. Many consensus selves. And in fact, they succeed each other with regularity, in my opinion. That would be the Gurdjieffian analysis, that it's a succession of discrete little selves. You know, I have this one thought that, gosh, this pie is delicious, and the next thought is, but I shouldn't be eating pie when I'm supposed to be talking, for goodness sake.
So you're saying that once one gathers enough data and can infer a larger, more accurate picture of that whole process that you just demonstrated right now, mm-hmm. that one might not have to act only through those modes? Is that
through the...
Those modes?
Yes. That is the basic idea. Mm-hmm. That all the great spiritual teachings talk about something like, or so it seems to me at least, talk about something like acting from complete freedom and from inner authenticity. And the level of inner here is very profound. It is more, or I should say, it is less accessible than we generally take for granted. Our usual experience of things, usual, not 100%, but usual, is, I'm suggesting, not... is often masks this level. Our usual experience of ourselves, because ourselves is mostly this consensus self, masks this thing underneath, or this capacity underneath, this potential authenticity underneath. Once again, underneath itself is, of course, an analogy. But go ahead.
Well, okay, so suppose I do a whole bunch of digging in the dirt and get a really great idea of what my consensus self cares about, mm-hmm. how it behaves, how it will likely react to certain situations and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Then what?
Then what indeed? My suggestion is that there are different ways to gather evidence, and it matters how you do the evidence. Just like in archaeology, you can go in there and grab the goodies and record nothing, say nothing, notice nothing about the context. And then you've got the goodie, the great artifact, whatever the heck it is.
They worship gold cats.
Right, gold cats. You've got your gold cat, and if you want to say something about how that gold cat came to be, how that gold cat played a part in the life of the people who created it, used it, put it wherever they put it, moved it in the ways they moved it, etc., you have nothing. You have nothing. And that's the way, unfortunately, our minds are set up. Our minds are always, you know, the latest thought. I've got it. This is it. This is the best. This is, you know, now I understand. That's the way the mind tends to work.
And, I don't think women's minds work that way.
Really?
Sorry.
All right. That would be interesting.
We already know, right? Intuition being women.
Fair enough.
Well,
tell me about how women's minds work.
Clues about a woman. First, our acculturation is different from men. Our brains work differently.
How do you know that?
I read it. Accredited authorities that our brains work differently.
Got that.
But what I do know is that motherhood makes a huge difference in how we comprise or compose ourselves. That this is a big change, and it absolutely changes yourself when you, mm-hmm. you become a mother.
Okay.
Because you subordinate.
Makes sense to me.
You subordinate personal wishes to the welfare of your child.
Okay.
And you do this all your life.
Okay, but what does that have to do with my point about the mind working in this way that, aha, now I understand. You're saying that women don't have...
I have never said, aha, I understand.
Okay.
With any certainty about anything, but I have gut
feelings.
I have gut feelings about my role as a woman and my role as a mother and how that has changed my life. And
well, I got that. Well, how do you know those gut feelings are not something similar to what I'm saying?
I don't know. But I think I are coming from a different mindset, too.
Uh-huh. Well, of course. But the point here is always to be asking where these things are coming from. See, it's the big thing that I am always interested in. How do I know what I think I know? How do you know what you think you know? And the problem with a gut feeling is you can have someone like George Bush saying he's got a gut feeling about the premier of Russia, and it turns out that gut feeling wasn't all that reliable.
That's a gut feeling about something external.
Uh-huh.
George Bush is not a mother either. So.
Good point. That is true.
I think you missed the second word.
Well, the point here to me is that in my view, these things that we think of as gut feelings, these things that we think of as ideas, these things that we think of as emotions,
as
anything, as bedrock or not, are all the subject of interrogation. Just like everything in the archaeological matrix, all the sediment, all the inclusions, every artifact is all about interrogation of its relationship to everything else. And the problem is that when we make assertions about
motherhood,
about something that applies beyond you, I totally accept your statements about your experience. How could I deny that? That would be silly and pointless and stupid. But then you're also making statements about women and motherhood, and I'm simply pointing out, okay, maybe you're right, but where's your evidence? That's all.
That's only my own experience.
Right. But
not apply to other people at all.
That's right. And your own experience is itself not necessarily what I'm suggesting that meditation in various forms might lead us to see is that even the elements of your own experience are not necessarily as reliable as you have been used to thinking about them, as we in general have been used to thinking about them. That's the reason I adopted a spiritual path in the first place. That's the reason that because I had come to a place in a personal relationship which I thought was going to be my lifelong, you know, spousal partnership. And it turned out that, after 2 years, it just wasn't working out. And no matter what I did, it just wasn't going to work out. And I didn't know, and I didn't understand why this had occurred to me. I did not understand that, and I can have very strong intention. I can have very strong follow-through. I can have a lot of energy to pursue things and push things. And yet with all that, it didn't work out. It didn't, it was not meant to be, to follow this scenario that both my mind and my emotions had colluded, you know, in partnership with my body, which was having a good time, at least for the first, you know, for quite a bit of the time there. It all colluded to create this self, or more precisely, really, this set of selves
these stories that I told myself, that I came to see somehow just weren't really stable, weren't really the truth, weren't really accurate. So when I met my teacher, the point that grabbed me was, well, here's a methodology to find out about this and to find out where some stability might be sought. Not in the ways and the places that I thought were the only places that I knew of to look or could imagine a source of stability.
I still think women approach these things from a different place.
A lot of people make that assertion. One of my best friends in the spiritual world, who I have great respect for, makes a similar assertion. But even if that's so, even if men's the male organism and the female organism have different propensities, somewhat different or radically different, does it really change this fundamental question of how I come to know who I am or what I am or how I can learn about these things?
Maybe you just take a different route.
I got that. Well, everyone takes a different route, if I'm right, because if we're all these composite aggregations of things, then necessarily our roots through this soup of a universe that we live in must be different. Dan had something.
I was just kind of hoping you might say a few words with regard to the Buddhist concept of non-self in this context.
Well, I think that's that's been an interesting one for years and years. Jim and I have had this ongoing conversation about it. It's been a fertile and interesting arena of interrogation for me, and I've enjoyed it very much. What Dan is referring to is basically the Buddha responding to a conversation that was ongoing in India at the time that he was working. And this conversation about non-self or not self was about the idea of the self being defined as a separately existing thing, discrete from everything else. And the Buddha said, these selves, even gods, are part of this process. Even divine beings are part of the process of aggregates coming together and dissolving, and this soupy big old mix of everything touching everything else, ultimately, at least potentially, that's an interesting point of view. So he was talking about a very particular formulation of the idea of the self, which is that the self is in fact this discrete thing, and we can relate it to our understanding today. When, you know, I have this background, a Catholic background, and the idea there is the self is the soul, and the soul is this thing that came into existence because God willed it to be so, and this soul is essentially more or less discrete and separate from everything else. And although it doesn't really make much sense what I was taught,
honestly, because then if I'm bad in this life, then the soul goes to one place and gets punished, and if I'm good in this life, then it goes to another place and is exalted. It really doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. But the Buddhist idea of no self or not self is basically part of that conversation. And it's relevant to us if we think of the self, as we tend to do, as being more or less discrete and not constantly being affected by others. So here is this material culture evidence that I brought about birthday, the relationships inherent in this human ritual of birthday celebration in this particular cultural matrix, right? And I've got all this evidence to suggest that I am affected by. We were talking about the bar of soap, wherever the heck that went to, and there it is, and the bar of soap is like a part of a conversation. In fact, we had a conversation about it here, and people got to look at it, and it's funny. It's a cute little artifact, a very clever gift for someone who wanted to amuse me. As I was amused, I was delighted. I thought it was one of the more charming gifts I've been given, because it even if I read the intention right of the person who gave it to me, it's even meant to lampoon parts of this surface self that I generally seem to offer to the world, and that's funny, that's hilarious to me. I enjoy that. That's a give and take. That is one of the fun things we can do with these selves. You see, I'm not suggesting that the consensus self is like, you know, we must become Ramana Maharshi in a diaper, you know, like that's heck with, you know, right now my father in his dementia is, you know, coming in some ways to resemble Ramana Maharshi in a diaper, except he doesn't want to wear the diaper. It depends, that is. And that's okay. He gets to do what he's doing. But I'm not saying that ultimate authenticity is about completely eliminating, blowing up, destroying the consensus self. I'm saying that it's fun to play with instead of taking it seriously, instead of being wedded to it. So to me, that's the not-self that I find interesting, that I find challenging, and that is one of the potential products of the process that Daniel was trying to get at earlier in his last question that he asked about this process. So like everything else that I've been talking about, this interrogation of consensus self, this interrogation of our habits and tendencies, as well as our ideas of who we are, our habits of how we present ourselves, should be something that we can make fun of. Or enjoy others making fun of it. Instead of, you know, I could have said, you know, she thinks that I look like this silly looking cowboy slicker dude, you know. I think it's funny. In fact, I used to try to grow a mustache kind of like that one in the picture on the soap bar. And I was terrible at it.
When you had one.
Yeah, it was never very good. It never made it. You know, Stuart has done better with that. Robert was the best.
Like handlebar mustache.
Yeah, I couldn't. My mustache didn't do that very well. But but you know, it's funny. These creations
are wonderful. The place where I diverge from other folks' view of consensus self is I don't want to have to be told I have to take it seriously. I don't want to have to be told that this is not something I can joke with and change in an instant. Yesterday I was at at my father's retirement community. They have a birthday dinner once a month for all the people who have birthdays in that month. And so I was there, and they had this actually quite good jazz trio playing music, and they also had this really beautiful and elegant couple who are, I guess, hired to encourage some of the people in the place to come out and dance. And the first they did some dancing. There was this very handsome, dapper black guy and this very beautiful, thin, elegant woman. And they were doing this fantastic dancing. And then they were inviting people. And eventually, my brother and myself each had our turns to be invited to dance. Now, I'd never learned ballroom dancing. Never had that training. So I was sort of, you know, if I'd been wedded to my idea of, as arose for me in my head, if I'd been wedded to, I must defend myself from looking silly, then I would have refused to get up and dance. But I got up and danced. And because of my training, I can move my body around. I don't have fears that I used to believe in and take seriously about looking silly, or about in many things anyway, and certainly looking silly dancing. So actually, because I can, you know, I can get down, as it were, as is said.
Fake it till you make it.
What's that?
Fake it till you make it.
Well, I wasn't trying to do ballroom dancing. Instead, I was doing something else. And this lady who was dancing, she was delighted. She was charmed. She said, "You're fun. You're fun to play with." And we were doing, and we were, you know, we had a great time. And you know, people were complimenting me afterwards. That wasn't the point of doing it. The point of doing it is to demonstrate that we don't have to take these things too seriously. It's not like I had anything worth defending there. In that context, I could just demonstrate that it's not about defending some precious illusion of who I am, and people, I mean, a lot of people actually came up to me and, you know, were making comments to me afterwards. And I mean, I was limber and things like that, you know.
I wasn't, but
actually there was, this woman danced with some, you know, like a teenager or something like that too. And, you know, one of the family members or something. But it was fun. It's fun to take these things not so seriously. How do you do that? By gathering evidence in the way that we were talking about, that I was talking about with Daniel. So, this process of gathering evidence does not come about straightforwardly. There are many techniques that can be used, but what I'd like to do right now is a technique called co-meditation. It's a two-person meditation form. It's very simple. And you can turn and face someone that you're sitting immediately adjacent to and establish eye contact with that person. Looks like we've got just the right number here. Perfect. We'll do this for just 2 minutes. So the idea is you're going to sit facing this person more or less comfortably, not touching, but as close as possible without touching. And you're going to establish and maintain eye contact. Now, if you cannot refrain from having an expression that is communicating something with your expression, just maintain an impassive face, that's the ideal. But just sit and establish eye contact. Begin. Stop. You can bow or otherwise acknowledge your partner. And just turn back. So that's the kind of evidence gathering, that's a very tiny taste of the kind of evidence gathering that I'm talking about. This is using the experience of everyday life to look at how you relate to other human beings. And not just on the surface. How you relate to other beings in your own interior inner life. The thoughts, emotions, and even bodily sensations that arise in connection with being in contact with another human being, even when there is no necessary agenda being enacted, no communication being part of the co-creation of the moment together. That's the kind of evidence that goes underneath the surface mind. That's the kind of evidence that allows us to find something that is not about the talking. Not that there's anything wrong with the talking. The talking in our heads naturally arises. The voices naturally arise. No problem. But do we want to take them seriously? I don't. That's the same relationship that I'm talking about having with a self that doesn't want to look foolish in front of other people a moment ago. What I'm suggesting is we can have this kind of evidence absorption of an awareness to evidence. We can make ourselves open to evidence in such a way that we do not judge the evidence as good fact, bad fact. I like this, I don't like that. And that's the way that we get in touch with that part or aspect of something that we might call a self that existed before we could speak, externally or internally. We were here. We were each here in bodies smaller than the ones that we see around us right now and that we find ourselves in at the moment. But we were each here, for sure, with no capacity to speak, and yet we could know what we wanted. We could know what we didn't want. We could even, to some extent, communicate. And we could interact with the universe. Now, the ability in an adult human body to interact with the universe is enormously greater than in an infant body that is still forming, still growing, still developing its capacities. That's why spiritual teachers like Jesus have recommended that people become as little children. It's to get to that place in ourselves, but with an adult body, which does not mean mindless or the erasure of thoughts, the erasure of habits of self-presentation necessarily, but it might mean not having to have to enact any of those things compulsively. And that freedom is quite free enough for me without having to go to the diaper in the cave sort of thing of Ramana Maharshi or whoever. That's, in fact, pretty cool to me, to be able to inhabit a human body that does not have to believe all the things, all the primate programming that it has been exposed to, and that it completely naturally exudes in its behavior. It is completely natural for us as social mammals to be highly influenced by one another. You know, I have hung out with lots of people over my life, and I end up picking up habits from them, physical habits, speech habits, etc. It's just inevitable, unless you're as rigid as a poker. And what fun would that be? Yeah.
You kind of, I maybe answered this question just in that last sentence right now.
Okay.
I was wondering if and or what you exude that you've taken on from your teachers, you know, maybe things that are not purely. So it gets tricky, you know. Do you exude things that you have picked up in your training that are not purely authentic to you? That's the question.
Sure, but the other part of the response is that they become authentically me,
right,
when I do them with freedom, the way I've just been talking to you now. this way in which I can be present with you. I don't have to be thinking in my head, and I can feel your energy right here, and I can speak with clarity, loudly if I need to, or softly if I prefer to, is something that I could not do, absolutely could not do, when I first met my teacher. Absolutely impossible. It would have been laughable. I couldn't even get in front of the experience that comes to mind is when I was 17, I got an award in high school. I was so frozen, I could barely shuffle up to the stage, get the award, and escape the attention and get back to my seat, you know, with my parents and everybody there. It was, I was really, really, really afraid of attention. So
the question is, are you you now, or are you your teacher now?
That's a good question. I happen to think that I'm more me for having absorbed things from all the people that I have been in contact with, rather than less. I am composite. It would be a mistake to interpret what I'm saying as I'm trying to get to some place of purity that is not contaminated by contact with other things. There is nothing else for this to express is the entirety of all we are. So freedom must be expressing it without fear and without compulsion. Or at least that's one way to look at it.
That's interesting. In my personal relationship with you, I have thought I've understood some of your recommendations to mean that I might not, or even I shouldn't, I don't think you ever said should or shouldn't, but mm-hmm. that I don't have to have my reactions to things outside of myself mm-hmm. Determine in any way my manifestation.
Right.
So there's a discontinuity then between what you just said, at least for my conceptual mind.
Okay. Well, the way that I understand things to work, and I saw my own teacher struggle with this himself, because he had his teacher, or he had several teachers, but one, the main one, was a guy who was just an enormous presence, just psychically huge, very hard to be on the same stage, in the same room with this guy without everyone being focused on this one particular guy, his teacher. And so I think he had the idea that to be a teacher, even I don't think it was even completely conscious, but to some extent he had the idea from that example that to be a teacher he had to be like that. And over the years I saw him let go of that idea, which meant he could embody the qualities that were so powerful in his teacher without having to do it in a way that invalidated the other parts of him that had these other reactions to those qualities. So it's a tricky thing. A spiritual teacher, an authentic spiritual, someone who's acting to whatever extent from a place where compulsive habits do not, in the final analysis, hold sway. That's a very powerful demonstration
for a certain part of the being, I'm suggesting. And that can seem as if it's, or I'll back up. It's hard to find and disentangle the way that our minds tend to want to reproduce things from qualities in other people. This particular quality of being absolutely present without having the mind getting in the way at all, not an easy quality to copy or embody. But when you get it right, when one gets it right, then it's like what Betty said, actually. There is no question about it. There is clarity throughout the being, throughout the body, the heart, and the mind. They are unified Gurdjieff's talking about that kind of place where the being acts. The being can only act when there's unity of all the parts. Well, that's what we're discussing here, and that unity is in some ways a byproduct of this process. Although often enough, you see people, and I myself have suggested at times that people strive to see the disunity between these parts of ourselves. Well, the authenticity emerges and pulls all this stuff along. And does not surrender to the agendas of the different parts. The different parts have lots of different agendas. And there are many agendas in each self here in this room, and I'm talking about not just each discrete body, but I'm talking about each self within these body selves. There are lots of discrete selves in this room, and that's okay, because we are part of this big composite soup. And the archaeology of the self is about discovering where and how to find a way to see that with clarity, to embrace that soupiness and not be fighting it. The problem with our surface mind is that it's constantly judging and thus divorcing us from these qualities. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially the last, I mean, it seems like myself and most people usually feel like they're working against something.
Right. Right. That's right. And what is our inherent birthright, according to the great saints and sages, is no longer to be owned by that. No longer to be owned by that. So that you can dance. Well, it is quite late, and I am going to thank you all for coming tonight. This has been fun, and I appreciate your attention. I appreciate your questions. I appreciate your energy. And if anyone is interested in pursuing this on an ongoing basis, we have a Tuesday evening meeting. That's the Way of Tayu, that booklet that Jim is pointing out over there, which speaks about some of these techniques. The Tuesday evening meeting meets here in this space every Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. And
you'll be on the radio.
Oh, I'll be on the radio. Cool. Oh, on the Mystical Positivist radio show, that incredible Mystical Positivist radio show that happens every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m. on KOWS-FM at 103.7 on your dial, or KOWS.FM,
www.107.3.
Oh, sorry about that. You're right. Oops. See, that's why we need. That's why it's good to have these composite friends to correct our composite mistakes. So, thank you all for coming tonight. And Jim has a final announcement.